Dioji wasn't a good dog. Chastity took a winding random path back toward town, but we never saw any additional pursuit. I half expected Nan to roust a helicopter to track us beyond the blocked roadway, but we apparently didn't rate that kind of response. Not yet. We pulled over at a truck stop, parking in a spot where a row of trailers would hide us from the road. Chastity shifted into park, pulled out a revolver, and turned around in her seat so she could point it right at my face. I had lost count of how many guns had been pointed at me in the last hour. Was it 5? She said, "Tell me exactly what is going on here. Don't bullshit me. Don't sugarcoat it. Tell me the whole truth right now, because I'm telling you, I am on my last nerve here." I said, "Are you going to believe me if I do? Otherwise, we're just wasting each other's time." "I like to think I know the truth when I hear it." "Good. I had never seen your son before they found him in my apartment." "I believe you." "You do? Well, that's good, then. Someone stuck him in there to frame us." "No, that ain't right neither." "Okay, well, why don't you tell me what..." "There's something wrong with him. With Mikey. He isn't right. None of this is right." John said, "On that, we agree." Amy asked, "Is he talking, your son?" "Oh, he talks." "What does he say happened that night? Does he remember?" "Says your man here woke him up, standing in his bedroom. Says David snapped his fingers and suddenly they were someplace else. Some kind of fucked up Disneyland." I said, "Joy Park?" "How'd you know?" "It came up in the Maggie Knoll case. It's not a real park." "No shit, it's not a real park. Mikey says when you walk in the front gate, everybody gets a pair of wings. Let's everybody fly around from ride to ride. Try to look up Joy Park on the web, all you find are the biggest titties I've ever seen on an Asian girl. Then said you told him the last ride would involve him living in the belly of a monster." I said, "So what do you want from us? And before you ask me to tell you what's going on, I'll just stop you there, because we don't have any fucking idea. I want you to see him, my boy, to talk to him. I need someone else to understand, because I feel like my mind is splitting in half." I said, "Fine, let us talk to him." "Mikey won't talk to you. He thinks you're the one who snatched him." Amy said, "What about me? He doesn't have any reason to be scared of me, does he? What is it you want us to find out?" "I want you to find out if he's still my son." I thought, "Oh." John said, "You think he's been replaced by a lookalike?" She said, "The fact that you jumped right to that conclusion tells me you already know this is a possibility. Talk to him. You'll see." I scratched my chin and watched the rain for a moment. If the child she had gotten back was in fact just a swarm of fuck roaches, then the implications were almost too much for me to grasp. The question of where the real Mikey was being held was just the first in a series of questions I'd need a spreadsheet to sort through. John said, "All right, I want to get my dog in the room with him then. He can sniff out weird stuff. It's hard to explain, but if he is what you're suggesting he is, the dog will go nuts at the sight of him." Chastity said, "And then what?" "And then," I thought, "things will get awkward." Nan wasn't staking out Chastity's trailer or John's place, and neither were the cops. Still, we decided it wasn't wise to linger at either location. We wound up following Chastity to a motel, the rear window of the Jeep open a few inches so Dioji could stick his face out into the wind. We had gotten a break from the rain, which had turned into the kind of delicate drizzle that feels like a ghost is silently sneezing in your face. At 9 p.m., we were pulling into what was without a doubt one of the 5 shadiest places in town, a sprawling beat-up motel that never had any vacancies. This was the Roach Motel. It was owned by a local biker cult leader named Lemmy Roach, and half of the rooms were meet-up spots for local prostitutes and drug dealers. The rest served as a headquarters compound for Roach's motorcycle gang, Christ's Rebellion. In a town full of groups competing to see who could live the furthest off the grid, I'd say Christ's Rebellion probably did it with the most style. The name wasn't intended to be ironic or sacrilegious. Roach was a true believer. Once, while recovering from a traumatic brain injury, he had received a revelation from God, charging him with a singular mission, to do exactly what he would have done anyway, only more of it. Thus, his faction of Christianity was based around the concept that the only law was God's, and that the government prohibitions on victimless crimes were mere annoyances to be circumvented. Roach figured, if a person wanted to smoke methamphetamine or get a blowjob from a hooker, that was a choice that person was free to make. Harsh legal consequences were just adding suffering to sin, so humanity's duty was only to ensure that all was done under the umbrella of safety and consent. Otherwise, he said, each of us is responsible for our own soul. I only know all of this because John bought shit from Roach and once had dragged me along to a big festival CR throws every November, in which they gave out frozen turkeys and winter coats to needy families. Lemmy had spent an hour bending my ear with his whole convoluted Christian libertarian worldview before I was able to escape clutching several typo-riddled pamphlets. We waited in the parking lot while Chastity talked to a fat dude at the front desk. It seemed like not only did they know each other, but that he wasn't charging her for the room. John said, "That's weird." I said, "What?" "Maggie's mom. I think she said Ted used to take Maggie to Sunday school here. That can't be coincidence, right? Maybe Ted's part of Lemmy's, what's a more polite word for cult? I think Lemmy's right over there." There was a group of about six bikers across the parking lot, standing around a 50-gallon drum with a fire raging inside it. I spotted Lemmy among them, a gangly ginger guy. They were all shouting at a tearful woman, one of the men occasionally hugging her. It looked like an intervention of some kind. I noticed each of the men had a shotgun slung over his back. I'd recommend the same if anyone ever tried to spring an intervention on me. Amy said, "We should talk to him." I said, "Later. That whole situation looks super awkward." Chastity came back out and got Mikey from the Range Rover, a perfectly normal-looking boy, about 7 or 8 years old, and led him to a room. The goal, obviously, was to figure out if Mikey was some kind of carnivorous doppelganger without traumatizing him for life if it turned out he wasn't. The plan was for me and John to stay out in the Jeep while Chastity and Amy would go inside and talk with the kid, or kid. They'd chat a bit, explain to him what we were doing, or, you know, give him a version of the story that wouldn't terrify him, then bring in the dog. Before going in, Amy spotted the local hot dog guy a block away, pushing his cart with the orange and yellow umbrella, the cart itself plastered with bumper stickers warning about the dangers of jihadists and Obamacare. A minute later, she walked into the room where Chastity was sitting on the bed with Mikey, armed with a hot dog and a soda. She closed the curtains, blocking our view from the parking lot, while also blocking Mikey's ability to see that his alleged kidnapper was sitting creepily in a vehicle outside his room. We'd still be able to observe, thanks to the magic of technology. Amy set up a video call and propped up her phone on a dresser, so we'd be able to watch the conversation unfold from the Jeep via John's phone. On the video feed, we watched as Amy held up the hot dog and soda to Mikey and said, "You hungry?" Mikey looked at his mother, silently asking permission. She said, "Go ahead. You can trust her." Mikey took the food and said, "Thank you," without having to be reminded to do it by his mother. He pulled the hot dog out of its wax paper wrapper and set it in front of him. Chastity said, "This here's a friend of mine. Her name is Amy. She's not with the police. You can relax. She's not just a lot prettier than them, but I think you can tell just by looking at her that she's got a good heart. Just tell her what she wants to know. She wants to help us." Mikey nodded, but said nothing. He pulled the hot dog from its bun, then reached down with a pair of fingers and pinched off a piece of the hot dog's skin and ate it. Amy said, "How are you feeling?" "Okay." In the car, John said, "Ask him if he's a walking pile of fuckroach." Amy couldn't hear him, fortunately. We were muted on our end. Amy asked, What do you like to do for fun? Shrug. Do you like to play video games? Sometimes. What's your favorite game? Worst day of your life? That's the name of the game. It doesn't sound very fun. I like the level where you make the old man poop his pants at the mall. I can make him cry every time. You have to make his grandkids laugh at him. That's how you do it. He peeled another strip of skin off the hot dog, revealing innards that looked like pre-chewed meat. Your mom homeschools you, isn't that right? What's your favorite subject? He shrugged. I like smelling the bad memories. Mom says I'm the best at dream carving. We did metahistory this week. It's hard. Do you know why girls make more noise than men during sex? What? I expected Chastity to be mortified, but instead she looked up at the camera as if to say, "See what I mean?" It was to attract other males in the tribe, said Mikey, sounding bored, so that when one was finished, the next could jump right in. That's why a man's wiener has that mushroom shape at the end. It's to scoop out the cum from the last guy so his own can get in. I saw a video where it was one woman and 20 men, one after another. She was tied down, but you could tell she liked it. And that's how it was for all of history. The whole tribe would share. That's what girls are built for. A guy shoots his wad and he's done, but a girl is good to go for the next guy. And the next, and the next. Hey, said Amy. Do you like dogs? Amy excused herself from the room and came out to the Jeep to get Dioji. I said, if the dog goes nuts, you get out of there, right? Don't try to talk to Mikey. Don't try to taser him. Just get out. Amy didn't reply. She wrapped Dioji's leash around her hand and led him inside the room, ready to restrain him if he went wild. In the parking lot behind us, there was a commotion as the woman the bikers had been counseling went running off down the sidewalk. Lemmy gave chase, shouting, "You're making a mistake, Eva! This is your family! Right here!" On the video feed, Dioji remained calm as Amy closed the door behind her. Mikey didn't take particular interest in the dog, just glanced at it as it came in. Dioji sniffed around, but it was clearly because he was trying to trace the origin of the hot dog scents. Mikey looked away from the dog, shook his head, and said, "Pathetic. Packs of wolves used to own this land. All this. Thousands of years pass, and we bred them down to that little yapping thing. Bred them to catch rats. Gave them those tiny little legs. There's a place where the Nephilim did that to the people." Mikey had pulled the straw out of his soda and was slowly screwing it into the end of his skinned hot dog, skewering it. "They took over, bred us so we'd have no teeth so they wouldn't get in the way when they wanted us to suck 'em off. Gave us short little legs so we couldn't run. Only where we bred dogs so their brains would be addicted to our affection, the Nephilim bred us to be addicted to their semen." Amy nervously said, "Dioji, why don't you go see Mikey over there?" She led the dog over, but it continued to show complete indifference. I looked up from the phone and said to John, "I'm thinking your dog might be useless." "You're assuming this is even the same deal here, that Mikey and Nymph are the same thing." On the screen, Mikey said, "You don't think I'm the real Mikey, do you?" Chastity shot an alarmed look at Amy, then at the phone, meaning us. She said, "Why would you say that, honey?" "Maybe the real Mikey is still at Joy Park. Maybe you should check." Amy said, "Where is Joy Park?" "You know where. Unless you're talking about the girl with them titties." Chastity said, "We'll be right back." Chastity and Amy both stood up to excuse themselves, and it was here that Dioji first showed a reaction. Not to Mikey. He went nuts at the prospect of leaving the room. He barked and snarled at Amy, and even nipped at her when she tried to grab the leash. But when she backed off, he became perfectly calm. She wound up just leaving Dioji in the room. If Mikey tried to attack him or something, I guessed we'd have to go rushing in to the dog's rescue, even if it had turned out that he was shitty at his one job. A moment later, Chastity and Amy slid into the Jeep, and Chastity said, "See what I mean?" I said, "Let's say it's an imposter. To me, the big news is that your son is still out there, and if he's really at Mind's Eye, then I don't know where to..." Chastity was shaking her head. "No. I know it's hard to wrap your mind around it, but we've seen..." "No, it's deeper than that. All of this is." I said, "If you've got a theory, please share." Chastity stared out the windshield at the row of hotel doors, each painted a different primary color. It was probably supposed to be festive, but the effect was more sad, abandoned circus. She said, "One time, I read about this parasite, a tiny little roundworm. It spreads itself by getting inside birds. Then the bird's droppings are full of its eggs. Well, the parasite's first problem is getting inside the bird in the first place, you see? So here's what it does. It infects an ant. Then it makes the ant swell up big and red so that it looks just like a berry. Then it takes over the ant's brain and convinces it to go climb up a tree and stand there among the other berries. Bird comes along, eats the ant, thinking it's a berry." I said, "I don't get it." Chastity was staring hard at the hotel room window, nothing visible behind the closed curtain. "When Mikey got taken, the first thing I thought of was 2 years ago on Mikey's 6th birthday. I took him to Pizza Circus, and I remember he got scared by those fiberglass clowns they got on the wall and we had to leave early. Took him home and made him a grilled cheese instead. That's his favorite. We sat on the sofa and watched a movie, that cartoon where Chris Rock plays a zebra and they're all zoo animals trying to escape. I think I laughed more than he did." She stopped talking, staring at that window. We waited for her to finish the story, but she just stared. I thought I saw the curtain twitch, like maybe Mikey was sneaking a peek out at us. It was Amy who finally said, "2 years ago? That's not right. Pizza Circus got trashed during the last round of craziness, with the looting. Never opened back up." Chastity just nodded. "I don't have a son. I never did." Chapter 13. "Wait, what the fuck?" I said, "That can't be, no. You absolutely thought you had a son as of, like, an hour ago." She nodded, absently. "And I got memories, going back 8 years. But they don't make sense if you think about them hard enough. It's all bent and twisted. He don't got a room of his own at the trailer, supposedly on account of my losing my last place in a fire. But he don't got clothes or toys, neither. But how would you not notice that, like, instantly?" She shook her head. "You seen them TV shows about the hoarders? People got garbage piled up so high they can't even walk from one room to the next. Family tries to intervene, but those people literally can't see the garbage, can't be convinced anything's wrong. Your mind, it gets these blind spots to the most basic things. I got a cousin who weighs 600 pounds, but all thought of that goes out the window next mealtime rolls around. And then I got to thinking about that parasite. All that little worm is doing is convincing the ant that it's always been there, inside it, and that walking up the tree to where the berries are is its favorite thing, even though everything inside it should know it's suicide." I said, "But humans aren't ants. You're saying this thing showed up and convinced you that you had already had a son, complete with thousands of memories going back years? How would that even work?" Amy said, "Your memories are physical structures in your brain. It would be the exact same process as the ant, just a little more complicated." John said, "The fuck roach. We could all feel it trying to worm its way into our history. Not just looking like a cell phone, but making us remember that it was one, making it just plausible enough." Amy said, "What's worse, it looks like the dog can't detect these things after all. If we're now sure Mikey in there is one of them?" John said, "Eh, It's not the first time he's been wrong. He totally whiffed on that possessed stuffed bear I won at the fall festival. Just kept humping it. Amy said, "What are you talking about?" "You don't remember the thing with the bear?" "It was when I still lived in that apartment on..." Amy clutched her hair with her one hand and said, "Oh my God, you think you've always owned that dog?" I said, what? Amy threw herself back in the car seat. "I've never seen that dog before today. I thought John was just dog-sitting or something." I stared at the motel room door. No, that's Dioji. He and Molly never got along, chewed up one of your sandals one time. I have never lost a shoe to a dog. Behind the motel room window, the curtain twitched again. John said to her, "No, this is... They're scrambling your brain here. This is you, not us. I remember everything. This used to be Marcy's dog. He stayed with me when we broke up. Her roommate was allergic. Years ago, same year as we had that bad winter and all the stuff happened." I said, "Yeah, it has to be Amy who's wrong." "Again?" I said to her, "You remember the night all those guys burst in looking for the, thing a few weeks ago and you threw it in the river?" She shook her head. "I remember that event, but there was no dog." John said, "We took him to the vet. He ate the chocolate." "Do you have the receipt?" "Sure, I..." "Wait, no, she didn't charge us." "We did not go to the vet that night, John." Chastity said, "If you concentrate, if you focus hard on them memories, you can break them apart. Find the real memories in there. Hiding. See, they picked the wrong target with me. You can make me doubt the world, but you won't make me doubt myself. My memory, my false memory, was telling me that Mikey's father was some guy I slept with, a guy I met at a lake and then left town after a one-night stand. But I ain't never done that in my life. The kind of man who does that, he don't make it to my bed. And if I had a kid, a real one, I'd be living in a better place, in a better town." I said, "And your friends, your family, they wouldn't wonder why you're acting like you've got a child out of the blue? Don't talk to my family, what there is of it. And I'm not much for socializing. That thing, it knew it. Picked me for a reason, I'd say. But it didn't take." John said, Okay, so let's focus on the most immediate problem. Now, they're both in there in that room, the kid and the dog, neither of which are of this world. What the hell do we do? Leave?" Amy said, "If we can get it to drop its disguise, can we, I don't know, talk to it? Find out what it wants?" I said, "How in the world do we get it to drop its disguise?" John said, "We'd have to make it want to." "Wait, while it's in dog mode, does it have to behave like a dog? Maybe I go in and say, 'Oh, look, since you're just a dog, surely you wouldn't mind licking some peanut butter off of my balls.'" "Maybe just knowing we can see through it will be enough," suggested Amy. John said, "I wish we still had the soy sauce. It would know what to do." Chastity said, "The what?" I said, "What he's referring to is slang for a substance. Think of it as a performance-enhancing drug for people with any kind of paranormal abilities. Or whatever. It's the reason we can do what we do." John said, "I'm 99% sure that on the sauce, we would be able to see through the thing's camouflage, through the whole illusion." "Anyway," I said, "it's moot, because we tossed our only vial of this stuff into the river." Chastity said, "Well, that conversation was a good use of our time." I said, "All right, so we go in, and we talk to it, and try to find out what it wants. And if what it wants is to feed on us and, breed on us, then what?" We all just looked at Chastity. Only she could say this. "We kill it. Only cure for a parasite." She looked at us. "Any idea how we do that?" John said, "They don't like fire." Amy said, "We're not going to start a fire in an occupied motel." Chastity nodded. "So much crack in this place, fire would get the whole town high. No, we gotta take him somewhere else, away from all the people. Mikey and your dog both." John said, I know a place. All four of us cautiously approached the motel room door. The only one of us who was armed was Chastity, with her revolver. John asked her if she wanted him to take the gun. No. If this goes wrong and something has to be done, it'll be me who does it. I said, just be ready. This thing is going to try to pull on your heartstrings. It's going to play up the little kid stuff. He's going to bat his eyes and say, you wouldn't shoot me, Mommy. You sure you're ready for that? Nope. But I'll do it anyway. If you're telling me you wouldn't have any problem pulling the trigger in that situation, well, that ain't nothing to brag about. She steeled herself, pushed open the door, and screamed. From the neck down, the creature standing in the doorway was little Mikey Payton, just as we'd seen him, wearing a faded LeBron James t-shirt. From the neck up, he was Dioji, specifically the ass part. The dog's two rear legs were draped over Mikey's chest, its tail stuck straight up in the air where Mikey's forehead would have been. The dog's anus opened and closed like a mouth and said, "Look, Mommy, I'm a butthead." Chastity slammed the door. I said, "Okay, I was not expecting that." The huge, gun-toting, screaming black woman had drawn the attention of the bikers around the burn barrel. The fat guy from behind the counter leaned his head out of the office a few doors down, looking annoyed. It sounded like motel rules were being broken. Lemmy Roach said,
"Chastity, what's happening?"
I said, "Nothing to see here. It's fine." Then the curtains of our room were ripped aside, and what appeared there wasn't Mikey or the dog or dog butt Mikey. It was a naked young woman, visible from the hips up. She was splattered with blood and appeared to have one wrist shackled to a headboard with a pair of handcuffs. She pressed herself against the window and screamed, "Help! They're going to kill me!" Two more guys ran out of a nearby room to join the bikers at the burn barrel. Roach yanked a pair of short shotguns into his hands and screamed,
"They've got Lacey!"
I was, in that instant, sure that no woman named Lacey had ever existed. I was also sure that every single person in the vicinity would instantly remember Lacey, have a head full of fond memories of her, and feel an overwhelming urge to protect her. Roach led a pack of bikers toward the door, each of them drawing firearms. Chastity screamed at them to stay back, and when they refused, brandished the revolver. "You go in there, you're gonna die! It's a trap!" Of course, the bikers had no reason whatsoever to believe this was anything but the ravings of a lunatic who had kidnapped a female friend of theirs, and also, they had shotguns. The sound of conflict had carried across the grounds, and room doors were popping open all around us, disgorging biker dudes eager to join the fight. One woman in black leather quickly hustled away three young kids. Some of these bikers had families. The woman behind the glass continued to scream and beg for help. John, Amy, Chastity, and I faced a phalanx of shotguns and black leather. Roach, brandishing a total of four shotgun barrels by himself, screamed,
"Chastity, you've got 3 seconds to put that down and get out of the way."
John said to him,
"This may seem like a weird time to ask, but do you know Ted Knoll?"
There was a commotion at the opposite end of the parking lot. Everyone spun around to see 3 black non-trucks come barreling in. There was no entrance to the lot over there. They just smashed through the motel sign and flattened a row of shrubs, skidding to a stop. A dozen black cloaks flowed into the parking lot, bringing their weird-ass weapons to bear. The naked woman in the window screamed and pulled on her restraints. The downpour chose that moment to resume. The nearest non-cloak was the same one that had led the charge into John's living room that night weeks ago. Or at least, this one was wearing the same puffy-cheeked infant mask. It opened its baby mouth. It had tiny little rubber teeth and said,
"Step away from the organism."
Thinking back, I'd say this was a mistake. These instructions made perfect sense to me, John, Amy, and maybe Chastity. That was it. No one else in that crowd knew what organism they were referencing, or where it was, or in what direction they should step in order to find themselves away from it. Most of the bikers had now trained their guns on the non-cloaks, with a few seeming to remember that their most urgent task was to free their beloved Lacey. We all stood that way for a moment, getting drenched in the downpour. To me, it seemed like a perfect time to just slip away and let these people fight it out amongst themselves. But there was no way to communicate that to the other three in a way that wouldn't tip off everyone else. At the window, Lacey screamed, "He's coming! Oh God, he's coming!" A muscular arm reached in, grabbed her hair, and yanked her back onto the bed, letting the curtains fall closed. That did it. Roach yelled,
"Get off her, you sick son of a bitch!"
and sprinted toward the door. He pushed past Chastity and blew the doorknob off with his shotgun. He yanked open the door and plunged inside. 5 seconds later, a spray of guts and black leather flew out of the door. What walked out of the door next was a torso. Lacey only existed down to her waist, which ended in rows of tiny fuckroach feet. She came scooting out of the doorway, the disembodied man's arm, which ended at the bicep, still clutching her hair. Chastity said, "Oh, shit!" and shot at the Lacey thing with her revolver. It flinched and pulsed, the fuckroaches giving up their disguise for a split second each time a bullet struck home. The non-cloaks screamed at Chastity to stop in their weird pseudo-human voices. Then Babyface fired a blue beam that was presumably intended to scramble her brain in some way that had neutralized the threat. It missed, and instead hit a member of Christ's Rebellion. The man screamed, "Violence is wrong!" He then threw his gun aside and lay down on the soaked pavement, appearing to go to sleep. The Lacey torso waddled its way toward the bikers, the spell having been thoroughly broken at this point. They opened up on it with their shotguns, blowing off fuckroaches with each blast. Babyface commanded them to stop shooting the specimen, and when the bikers didn't comply, another blue beam was fired at them. It hit a biker with a glancing blow that just brushed the back of his hair. He blinked, confused, then started firing his gun wildly into the sky, screaming, "Fuck you, moon!" The rest of the bikers were now torn between the disembodied torso monster and the squad of spooky assholes shooting shafts of magic at them. Some turned their shotguns on Nan, knocking down black cloaks and making a strategic retreat across the parking lot toward where their bikes were parked. Apparently, frustrated at being ignored, Lacey dispersed completely into a swarm, the creatures whizzing around until they coalesced into a group of 6 severed heads, each of the same elderly woman floating a few feet off the ground. The biker nearest to them had time to scream, "Grandma, no!" before they launched themselves at him and started eating his face. The man tumbled to the ground at my feet, and onto the pavement rolled the brushed steel canister, the vial Amy had chucked into the river 3 weeks ago, the one that contained the soy sauce. Chapter 14. A brief history of invasive fish species in the Mississippi River and their impact on international commerce. After Amy pitched the metal vial into the river, it in fact did not float all the way to the Gulf of Mexico as she had hoped. That would have required a series of remarkable coincidences, considering how many opportunities there are for a floating object to wash ashore or become ensnared in some obstacle along those hundreds of miles of heavily traveled waterway. The object did, however, make it to the Mississippi, where it was promptly swallowed by an 80-pound Asian carp. The carp boasted a proud, heroic lineage, though of course it was not aware of this, or anything else aside from a vague sense that being a fish was pretty sweet. You see, it is well known that the best way to catch catfish in the Mississippi is with cruelty. You simply take a smaller, living fish, ram a hook through its back, and secure the line to a float or an anchor. The terrified, impaled bait will desperately try to swim away until its frantic struggle attracts a catfish that will swallow it whole. In the 1970s, fishermen started using Asian carp for their live bait operations, but the carp quickly turned the tables. They ripped themselves free from their rigs, found mates, started families, and having no natural predators, promptly spread down the Mississippi like a conquering horde. It was only a few years ago that someone had the bright idea to catch and export Asian carp back to China, where they can still fetch a high price as a delicacy. Thus, the carp that swallowed the vial was caught the next day by a commercial fishing vessel owned by a man named John Minchin. The fish, with the vial lodged in its throat, was taken back to port and then crammed alive into a freshwater container along with 100 other carp just like it. The container was then transferred by forklift into the belly of an airliner. As the carp swam in its cramped, dark prison, it had no idea it was being flown around the world and, in fact, did not even know it lived in a world that could be flown around. It should be noted that 4 minutes after offloading the fish, a crew member on Minchin's boat tossed a cigarette that ignited fumes from a leaking fuel line. The ensuing explosion killed 2 men. The carp containing the metal vial arrived at a massive fish processing facility in Nantong, 7,370 miles away from where it had been caught. There, a machine designed to lop off the head of the carp smashed into the metal object in its gullet, causing the blade to shatter. This sent a shard flying into the neck of an unfortunate line worker who bled out in 43 seconds flat. An hour later, the line repair tech, a 23-year-old man named Min, replaced the ruined blade on the fish decapitator and, during cleanup, found the strange metal vial wedged in the works. Recognizing it as some kind of foreign object and not a loose part of any of the machine's components, Min washed the metal cylinder and marveled at its properties. It felt cold, as if refrigerated from the inside, but was otherwise featureless, no seams where it could be opened, no inscriptions or decorations. It had mangled the teeth of the processor, yet had not a scratch on its surface. Min decided to take the object home. His young wife suffered from multiple sclerosis and was unable to work a day job. However, she had an artistic streak and had discovered that it was therapeutic for her to make sculptures out of found objects, welding the pieces together and selling the finished products on the internet, if, that is, it was one of the few pieces she had not grown too attached to. Min thus tried to bring home any items he thought she would find interesting, though regardless of what he brought her, she would always smile and make the same little sound every time, as if gasping with delight. A week later, the metal vial had become the torso of a sculpture in the shape of a steampunk robot, its joints and limbs made up of springs and gears she had recovered from an old clock. The parts were held together with glue, as she had found the metal of the vial could not be welded or soldered. Still, she had finished the figurine and put it up for sale on the online craft marketplace Etsy. A week later, it sold to a teenager in Spain named Juan Jimenez. Unfortunately, he would never receive the item. The international FedEx flight carrying the parcel crashed into the French countryside, killing everyone on board. In the name of international cooperation and improving safety standards, the United States National Transportation Safety Board, NTSB, frequently sends teams to assist in the investigation of crash sites around the world. The lead investigator, named John Mendelson, discovered the vial when he accidentally kicked it, his attention drawn to this lone, unburnt object in a twisted pile of scorched metal that had been roasting in jet fuel for several hours. The vial was clean, the other parts of the sculpture having been blasted neatly off its surface. It seemed impossible that the item could be a factor in the crash, but he kept finding his curiosity drawn to it, particularly the way in which it seemed to always remain about 30 degrees below room temperature. More out of blind curiosity than anything, Mendelson decided to ship the object to a private aviation forensics laboratory in Wichita, Kansas, for analysis. This time, the cargo landed safely in Newark, and soon after, the vial was on a courier truck heading west. The route to Wichita would not have taken it through undisclosed, as the interstate bypassed the town completely. However, the driver of the courier truck, Minnie Johnson, heard from dispatch that traffic was backed up on said interstate for miles due to a truck full of bees that had overturned, blocking both westbound lanes. Dispatch did not let her know that a young man in a passing vehicle had jumped out in order to rescue the driver of that semi, only to be attacked by bees and promptly die from anaphylaxis. Minnie was forced to exit onto Highway 131 toward the creepy small city she always tried to avoid whenever possible. 2 minutes after entering undisclosed city limits, the driver approached an overpass and saw some dumb fuck in a Range Rover trying to pass a semi in the eastbound lane, setting the SUV on a collision course with Minnie's own goddamn face. Minnie braked, but knew that it ultimately would have no effect on how this situation would play out. She had nowhere to go, and at best could decrease the amount the Ranger Rover's cabin was compacted by 10% or so, to make it a little easier for the highway patrol to dig the body parts out of the wreckage. The life or death of the Range Rover driver was entirely in their own hands. She felt only a split second of relief when the Range Rover jerked aside and threaded the needle between Minnie's rig and the one in the other lane. That's because right behind the suicidal Range Rover was a psychopath with an even more fervent death wish. The driver of the flat black truck had his goddamned headlights off. Minnie uttered just one syllable of what was going to be an extraordinarily creative string of profanities before her rig slammed into the truck. Both vehicles went tumbling over the railing, the cab never detaching from the trailer, leaving it and the driver's shattered body dangling off the overpass just a few feet above the roadway that crossed below. Passing under the overpass at that exact moment was a pack of 6 motorcycles driven by members of the Christ's Rebellion gang led by Lemmy Roach, with John Beergut Klosterman bringing up the rear. Beergut happened to glance up exactly at the moment that the horrific collision took place overhead, a semi-trailer rolling and flying to pieces, sending cargo raining down on the roadway around the bikes. Beergut was so busy dodging debris that he did not feel that a single metal object had landed in the sweatshirt hood that was draped between his shoulder blades. The cylinder would remain there until he would tumble to the ground in the parking lot of the Roach Motel, being bitten by the flying heads of his own deceased grandmother. Chapter 15. Soy Sauce. I reached for the vial, but Chastity yanked me back up to my feet. Damn, she was strong. She screamed, "Let's go!" John saw what I was reaching for and lunged for it. He accidentally kicked it away instead, sending it rolling across the pavement. A running biker stepped on it, causing him to trip and fly backward, breaking his neck when he landed awkwardly on a parking block. This caused the vial to roll forward again, right toward Amy, who picked it up in stride. We all went stumbling away from the chaos. We were cut off from both of our vehicles, which were parked behind the bizarre three-way maelstrom behind us. We ran across a row of Harleys, and without hesitation, Chastity jumped on one and kicked the engine to life. John stopped, saw what she was doing, and straddled the next bike over. He started it, yelled at Amy to jump on behind him, and she did. I do not know how to drive a motorcycle. John peeled off down the street and yelled back at me something that sounded like, "Beanie Weenie." Chastity turned back to me and said, "What are you waiting for? Get on!" I did. We dodged through the sparse nighttime traffic, and I thought I was going to die. The raindrops were cold needles on my face. We followed John out to the industrial park, not too far from the ice factory where all this bullshit had begun. I knew where he was going. There were several vast buildings in the neighborhood that belonged to businesses that hadn't survived the economic downturn this town had gone through about 7 economic downturns ago. One was a former Beans and Weenies cannery, a sprawling gray structure with giant rusting metal letters welded to the front that said Beans, Weenies, in a bombastic font that made it look like the slogan for a dystopian totalitarian dictatorship. John's band had played a concert here years ago. At the time, the entire second floor of the abandoned cannery had been repurposed as a living space for a hippie artist commune. Back then, 20 or 30 people would drift in and out, living off the grid, though considering they were stealing power by splicing into nearby utility poles and getting city water from unmetered valves, they were actually very much on the grid. They just weren't paying for it. Then, one day, a kid died of a heroin overdose, and the company that still owned the land decided it was too much of a liability issue. They ran out the hippies and hired a security guard to drive around the place a couple of times a day to kick out homeless people who came in to drink and get out of the rain. Fortunately, said security guard was Tyler Schultz, a friend of John's. When we pulled up to the length of thin chain that served as a gate, Tyler dropped it and waved us past. We pulled the motorcycles inside the building to shield them from view. The cavernous structure was a clammy, drippy space, and much of the artwork that had been left behind by the commune was ruined. There was a faded, spray-painted mural on one wall depicting the Statue of Liberty covered in blood. Underneath it were the words, "War Kills." I passed a fiberglass Mickey Mouse with dollar signs for eyes and the word "greed" spray-painted across his chest. I don't know what that was supposed to symbolize. There was a creepy concrete snowman with a misshapen face and a single arm made of rusty rebar. John led us upstairs toward the quadrant of the second floor that had been devoted to the living area. The roof didn't leak in that particular spot, and four old sofas were positioned facing each other. There was still a pair of refrigerators in the corner and a sink. Chastity glanced around quickly, then went and stationed herself by a window. John said, "As far as safe houses go, this is pretty much the last one in town that I've got access to." I said, "I don't like it. The artwork out there is freaking out my worldview." Chastity said, "It could be worse. Can see approaching vehicles from right here. Six ways out of the building if you've got to make a run for it." She pulled out a roll of cash wrapped in a rubber band. She peeled off $300 bills and said, "You got 25 in change?" Amy said, "Keep your money. You didn't get Mikey back." "Stop with that. This isn't about charity or having a good heart. I don't pay you. Maybe next month one of my bosses assumes he don't need to pay me. Maybe that becomes the norm. Everybody pressuring each other to turn down their paycheck in the name of courtesy. Then nothing gets done, because people know they won't get paid, and underneath all our generosity bullshit, it's incentives that make the world go round. You did the work, you took the risk. You got 25 in change or not?" John did. Chastity said, "I had a go bag in the trailer. Now I'm kicking myself for not grabbing it when all this started. Too risky to go back there. Assume the Range Rover is a loss too." She was muttering all of this to herself, working through it. It was pretty clear she wasn't asking our advice. I said, "You're leaving town?" "You're not?" Amy said, "We have to stay and see this through." "And what does that entail, exactly? Seeing it through?" "Well, for one thing," said Amy, "we have to warn Ted." I said, "About what?" "About Maggie. Why would..." "Oh, fuck. You think she's like Mikey? Like she never even existed?" John scrunched up his brow. "Wait, no. They had a photo, remember? Ted pulled it out of his wallet. Looked like a picture you'd have taken at Sears. Do you still have it?" "No, but, you know, just because Mikey was one doesn't mean Maggie is." Chastity said, "If she is what Mikey was, then you've got to take it out. And I'm guessing the parents are still under the spell, thinking it's their kid, so good luck with that." Amy said, "If they are still under its spell, why did it work on them, but not you?" "I got a theory about that. See, I think it'd work on you, too. But it wouldn't work on your man there. John, I don't know him well enough. Could go either way. You, well, you seem like the kind of girl who'd wake a guy up at 3 in the morning just because you forgot to say goodnight." "I guess I don't get it." Chastity shrugged. "People can either feel unconditional love or they can't. Depends on what you had growing up, I think." To me, she said, "I expect your parents weren't in the picture, right?" She didn't wait for me to answer. "Mine neither. Grow up thinking love is something you earn based on performance, and you dole it out just the same." She said to Amy, "I bet when you and your man fight, you get madder and madder, while he just gets quiet and kind of dead inside.
You get more and more upset because you've got that love for him that can't be undone, no matter what. And that strain pressing against it tears you up. David there, I bet he just gets cold. Same as me. Can't fake that shit. Well, with that unconditional love comes blind spots. That's what they depend on. So Mikey started acting all crazy. My memories of him got all jumbled up. It didn't take too much to sever that connection. But a lot of moms, they die first. That love, that unquestioning love that pours out of some people just wipes out all the wrongs, make you overlook anything. I said, it's using it as a survival adaptation. You could say humans do the same. One thing we do know, they're real eager to get us to go to that mine. I assume something big and nasty is gonna jump out of there if somebody clears those rocks, right? John said, that would probably be the best case scenario. Well, said Chastity, I do wish you luck. I'm gonna go someplace peaceful and try to remember who I was before a monster rewrote the last 8 years of my life. Amy said, you don't even feel the slightest urge to stay and help? Sometimes the best help you can offer is to get your own self to safety and not add to the pile of victims somebody else has got to clean up. Problem isn't that there's not enough heroes in the world. Problem is too many dumb people assume they are one. I said, wait, one last thing. What was your connection to the motel back there? How did you know the Christ's Rebellion people? Did some business with Lemmy. He owes me a favor, or three. And no, it wasn't drugs or whores, nothing like that. I repair motorcycles. That's one of my several jobs. Why? Amy said, the Knowles had connections there too, trying to figure out what it means. You could ask Lemmy, but I'm thinking he didn't survive getting splattered across the parking lot back there. John was turning the soy sauce vial over in his hands. Chastity said, what's that? I said, that there is the soy sauce. The container that Amy chucked into the river a few weeks ago, found it on the ground in the parking lot of the Roach Motel, 6 inches from my feet. Well, that don't sound like luck. I said, in this town, it's not just good and evil. Behind the scenes, it's all these competing agendas. Those agents, the ones you rescued us from, they were convinced there's something that wants us to win. Chastity scoffed and shook her head. You people are cutting wires on the bomb and hoping you got the right ones. Promise me, you'll give me a couple of hours to get out of town before you blow it up. John said, that's why we have to take the sauce. We need to understand what's happening. Uh-huh. And this isn't the kind of understanding you get from peyote, where you sit there and stare at the wallpaper and think it holds all the secrets of the universe, drool running from your lower lip? I said, well, not usually. It's actually hard to succinctly describe the effects of soy sauce, in the sense that it's hard to succinctly describe the effect of a gorilla on a child's birthday party. It can go several ways. I said, you ever play video games? Probably not. Anyway, one time, John and I were playing one of the Grand Theft Auto games, and our character glitched through the floor and wound up in some foggy netherworld full of floating random objects and distorted characters locked in these broken, looping animations. I think soy sauce is kind of like that. It reveals the nature of the game by breaking it. And you're going to try to convince me to take some? I said, no, I'm pretty sure it would kill you immediately. Amy, too. With John and I, it, isn't exactly pleasant, but once we come down, we usually have a clearer idea of what needs done. Stay here with Amy while we take the sauce. When we come back, we might just know something that will help you, too, even if your plan is to run. She watched the window. 1 hour. If I see them coming before that, I'm gone. So what you're gonna do? Do it now. John was already twisting the cap off the soy sauce vial. You might have noticed that no one who examined the vial before now noted a cap, but that's how it works. It opens when it wants to be opened. Otherwise, I'm pretty sure that a group of guys with a diamond saw, a jackhammer, and that huge green laser from the Death Star wouldn't so much as smudge it. John tilted the bottle toward his mouth. A single drop of pure black goo formed at the lip of the vial, dripped, then swerved
as it fell. It completely avoided his face and splattered directly onto his crotch.
Son of a...
The sauce ate a hole in John's pants. He slapped at it as Chastity looked on, bewildered. The sauce vial tumbled out of his hand and landed on the tiled floor. John spasmed into a fetal position, clutching his groin. Then, a few seconds later, he stopped struggling. The soy sauce took him. John stood up, nodded thoughtfully, and said,
"Okay, they are going to find out we're here in 37 minutes, 24 seconds, unless we take measures." Yes, measures.
Then he sprinted across the room toward a window and dove through the glass. We ran after him, arriving at the shattered window to see John running across the parking lot below. Amy yelled after him, but I said, "Just let him go." I walked back and kneeled down to grab the vial. A thin little stream of the sauce ran out onto the tiles, inching toward me. No, crawling toward me, like a little thread-thin worm, acting with intent. The tiny black worm writhed and then curled as if sniffing the air. Then it flicked up toward my face, right at my left eye. Pain exploded through the back of my skull, and then the world was gone. My surroundings vanished from sight. This was not an uncommon experience on the sauce. Instead of kneeling on the linoleum floor of the Beanie Weenie cannery, I found myself shambling aimlessly around a barren landscape in which it looked like everything had been eaten by locusts. All was dust and leafless trees and little sprigs of vegetation that had been gnawed down to the roots. The sky was an acrid, cancerous ruin. As I wandered, I came upon what looked like a floating worm. It hovered about 3 feet off the ground. At its base was a pile of coiled loops that led up to a twitching bulb the size of a football, then a single segmented tube that extended upright until it ended into an opening. It turned toward me. At the top was a human mouth. The worm was a disembodied esophagus and digestive tract, ending in the bundle of small intestine. At the bottom, it possessed an anus, and in the front, a 6-inch-long erect penis. The mouth opened. A guttural song emerged. Soon, I saw another one, a digestive and reproductive tract floating free of whatever body it had been attached to, this one with female genitalia at the base. Its mouth opened and out fluttered a high-pitched song as if in response to the other. I backed away, but they were not pursuing me. They were pursuing each other. The two pulsing bundles of offal met, the mouths locked together in a kiss, and soon the penis was pumping away, the wet tangle of intestines falling to the ground and thrashing against one another in ecstasy. I soon encountered another such pair, and another, and another. Then I crested a hill, and below me was a massive pink pile of the intestine monsters engaged in an orgy, the mass rippling and throbbing. All around the perimeter were tiny versions, little bundles that inched along the ground like knotted earthworms. Then I blinked, and it was gone, or rather I was gone. I was now in a makeshift classroom, with small desks and a big sign on the wall bearing a Dr. Seuss quote, "Today you are you, that is truer than true. There is no one alive who is youer than you." The room was vacant, except for a single, rough-looking woman who was standing in the front, screaming and screaming into the empty room. Then I blinked, and I was standing in my apartment, in my bathroom. It was nighttime, and I could hear the faint drum of the rain. In walked Amy, who closed the door, lowered the lid on the toilet, and sat on top of it. She stared, straight ahead, in silence, covering her mouth with her hand. She was wearing her work clothes, a clean white button-up shirt and navy pants. The ceiling was dripping right into her hair, but she didn't seem to notice. And then very quietly, she started crying. I moved toward her, reaching out, but of course I wasn't there, and this wasn't happening, not right now, anyway. Soon she got up, dried her eyes, and left the room. I followed her through the living room. She swung her red raincoat onto her arms and headed out of the apartment. I followed, drifting like a movie camera on a rig, as she walked across the street to the convenience store, jogging through the rain with her umbrella. At the door, she wiped her eyes again, then went in and bought the last blueberry muffin from the little case on the counter. And then I blinked and I had a body again. I was lying in a